Hi, folks. Sam Cedar here. Today is Freebie Thursday. You will get an entire, almost an hour and a half of programming today, as opposed to the normal 40 minutes. Why am I doing this? Because I'm a very, very bad businessman. And I actually think that if I let you hear this entire show, which we did live from Occupy Wall Street, that you'll be more inclined to support the Majority Report by becoming a member for only 33 cents a day. I spent like 40 bucks on batteries just to do this this podcast today for free for you. I'm 40 bucks in the hole. So please, if you can, we really do need members to maintain the show and to not close off the entire thing to just members. Because I don't want to do that. I want to be able to get the word out and amplify the voices in places like Occupy Wall Street and amplify stories that are important for you to know and important to get into the mainstream media. So if you can, please become a member at majority.fm or majorityreportradio.com and support the show. In the meantime, enjoy.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 20th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live again. Not just again, as in we did it a couple of weeks ago. I'm talking about today. Again. From the park formerly named Zuccotti, now known as Liberty Plaza, Liberty Square, in downtown New York City, just yards away from Wall Street. The Occupy Wall Street protests continue on. We had some problems with our cell phone service here because all of these people protesting, of course, they have cell phones, which simply prove that capitalism works perfectly. The fact that they have cell phones, ladies and gentlemen, is the sine qua non of the celebration of capitalism. Of course, apparently nobody told those folks at Fox News that those socialists in Europe, they also use cell phones. Interesting. An interesting dilemma. And of course, if everybody was here on wired rotary phones, then they wouldn't be considered such hypocrites. Everyone knows that if you have a cell phone, you are, of course, enjoying the benefits of rampant crony capitalism, of massive fraud emanating from our financial system, an incredible wealth income wealth disparity. If you've got a cell phone, forget about it. You just click on your cell phone, and maybe you listen to like a little bit of, I don't know, Katy Perry. Justin Bieber. Those are the only names of musicians I know now because of my child. That's the only thing I know. So we are here down in Liberty Plaza. And just to give you a sense, you know, this is our fourth trip down here, our third successful broadcast to the extent that this is actually going out. I won't know until later when people tell me. But, it continues to grow. The difference that I've noticed today in the past, and again, it's a Thursday, not much happening, a lot of rain last night, so I think a lot of people are to the extent that they have access to some place to go to shower and to warm up, they're probably there. But there's a lot of people here And they are, the place is looking very organized and very clean. More so than I've seen in the past. Now, I think there's a sense, too, that there could have been some rain, so people have sort of bundled up a little bit. And the other thing that really struck me being down here is, in the past, surrounding the park, there were at least 100, if not more, cops. Blue-shirted cops, either congregating across the street or encircling the park. And they seem... there's still a lot of cop cars, but there's just not many cops around. And I think the city has sort of resolved itself to the fact that these people are going to stay here, and they are they're not hurting anybody. They're not disturbing anybody. And maybe the city shouldn't be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars having cops stand around waiting for one of their bosses, who may be annoying, to go and take a swipe at somebody. So there is a sense, at least today, of some type of normalization. But of course, while that's the case here in the park, the ripples of what's been going on here have been felt across the country. It has changed the media narrative. You're seeing the way that it's affected the news reporting of what's happening in this country. Suddenly we can be talking about jobs. Suddenly Eric Cantor, who the words income disparity would not have been coming out of his mouth, the idea that he would mouth the words income disparity 2 months ago would have been fantastical. He would have sooner come out and admitted some strange proclivities he might have, or the fact that his entire life is a fraud in some way, then said the words income disparity, which he is now feeling necessary to justify to the American public. And so the impact of these protests have been profound, and you can see the attempts by the establishment, the attempts by the right wing to discredit what's going on here. And part of what they do to discredit it is they've been saying that it's anti-Semitic. And I got to tell you, where I'm standing right now, 3 weeks ago, was the scene of a Kol Nidre service that, like I said yesterday, that many people could not have fit into my shul in my hometown of Worcester. And I don't see it. Maybe the sukkah. Was there a sukkah here? And it's down as Sukkot is over. Simchas Torah is starting tonight. There are Simchas Torah celebration being planned for Zuccotti Park. So to the extent that there may be an anti-Semite here, one could also say, if you're going to say, because there may be a random anti-Semite at this park, and I'm sure there is, because there's no place you can go into just about anywhere where you couldn't say the same thing. You'd have to say the same thing about MSNBC, because they pay an anti-Semite to sit on their programs. So that being the case now, other things, we're going to talk to Jeff Smith today. We're going to talk to Chris Cobb. You may have seen him on the videos. He's been down here from the very beginning. I'm not sure if he works for Fox News or some division of Fox News. We're going to be talking to Ted Alexandro. Well, hopefully, maybe we'll get a chance to talk to Cenk Uygur, who's down here doing his show, The Young Turks. He had a big announcement last night. Hopefully, we'll talk to him about that. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to talk to some more people. So we're down here again, and it's very exciting. A lot of new faces down here, a lot of press. We'll talk more. But one guy I wanted to talk to, who I've noticed probably since day one of the occupation of Wall Street, is a guy named Chris Cobb. And we'll take a video of him. Hold up your camera here. Okay. Now, you can't see. He's going to interview me as well. Can you hold this microphone simultaneously? Okay, hold on. Here he is. Chris, here you go.
No one will ever know the difference.
All right, so now
If you had seen any video or photographs coming out of Occupy Wall Street, you have seen this guy. Your name?
Chris Cobb.
Chris Cobb. And Chris has been here since day one shooting interviews with a makeshift video camera made out of a box.
It's a cat food box, actually.
A cat food box and a microphone made out of...
cardboard.
Made out of cardboard, and both donning the logo of Fox News. And so the first question I have for you is there a real camera in there?
You know, everyone asks that, and despite the fact that it's made out of packing tape and Elmer's glue and cardboard, a lot of people, nonetheless, with poor vision, have believed that it's an actual camera, but it's not.
And there's not one hiding
there's
in
there. No camera in here. It's all conceptual.
And you've been going around interviewing people since day one. Like, you were here on the 17th, or were you?
I was here on the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, all the way up. I actually started doing the fake Fox News reporter character after Jesse LaGreca had been interviewed by a Fox News reporter.
Now, Jesse LaGreca is the guy you've seen this video. He's wearing the union cap. He is a blogger at Daily Kos, commenter, and a diarist there. And so go ahead.
Yeah, he's a great speaker, Jesse is. And I noticed that Fox reporter that day was going around here at Occupy Wall Street trying to trip people up and get them confused, and he's basically making fun of them. And I thought, what would be better than holding a sign? It'd be better if I just made fun of him. So I got a baseball hat just like he had, and I got a blue shirt, and I started dressing like him, and I did fake Fox News interviews with people around here, and turned it into a big running joke.
And the amazing thing about it is there's no record of those interviews that you did.
There's some. I did some video. A lot of it, you know, I thought it was kind of an extension of Occupy Wall Street. You know, it's communicating with people, with activists and with tourists and people coming to try to actually talk about the issues. And I believe in a dialogue instead of a monologue, if possible.
And so give me a broader sense of why you're here in the first place. I mean, you didn't come down here specifically to... we lost the connection. We're back up, I think, hopefully. You didn't come down here specifically to do this. I mean, that was something that grew into it, right?
No, I actually came down originally to photograph the protesters because I'm a writer and photographer as well, and I wanted to, you know, document what was going on here. But after being here a couple of days, I realized that there's some really good ideas here, and I wanted to be a part of it, so I joined in. And there was an art group I tried to be a part of on a regular basis, but everyone kind of has been doing their own thing. And there was a zombie flash mob of zombies going around eating fake money around Wall Street. And that was a hit. That was funny. And I wanted to do something funny as well. So that's how this evolved.
And... in a broader sense, like what? Now, are you married to this now? I mean, like you got it. You're going to do this to the bitter end, or what?
Well, if you ask my girlfriend, I'm married to it because we hardly see each other now since the protest has began.
Is she down here at all, or no?
She has a job that keeps her busy like 12 hours a day. So. I come down here and I shoot video and I talk to people, and then I come home and go through the material I've gotten all day.
And
see her.
You're a freelance freelance. I mean, tell me what you do.
I'm an accidental freelance writer and photographer. I write for a couple different publications, including the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. They have a blog called Open Space, and that blog is actually really interesting because they're the only open blog in any major American art institution where you can write unedited what you want. And I've been a columnist for about a year there.
And give me a sense of what's changed. And you've been down here for 34 days now. Give me a sense of what's changed.
Well, in the beginning, you know, like you were mentioning earlier, you know, reporters are coming up and asking, like, oh, you have a cell phone or you have an iPhone or a laptop. you know, and they say, well, therefore you're a hypocrite, you dirty hippie protester, you know. But then some of us started learning, you know, we could unpack those arguments, and that's one of the biggest things that's changed is people now realize they can say, oh, wait a minute, we're not hypocrites, because the fact is that multinational corporations actually own the labor force, they own the means of production, they own the distribution channels, and they own, like, once you're in the marketplace, what products are available to the consumers. So actually, what's really changed is the degree to which protesters here have become educated about the issues, and the media coverage is, you know, we've gone from being, you know, a couple hundred people huddling together, you know, in the cold, to several thousand a day, and the communication is better, and people are joining in, and it's pretty interesting to watch, actually.
Do you, I mean, I assume it's not so hard to get a sense of what's going on. And you know, you made we were talking about, sort of ironically, the idea that that the fact that you have cell phones. Does it
make us hypocrites? No, because the corporations that we're trying to create dialogue about own the means of production, they own the channels of distribution, and they control what products go to market. So if you are a consumer in the United States, even the clothing you wear is controlled by way of what is available in the marketplace. And so although many reporters were coming down here from different news outlets saying what a hypocrite you are because you're dressed, if you were not a hypocrite, you'd be naked.
That's right.
And they say you'd be naked because the very clothing you wear, that little blazer and the little shoes you're wearing, are manufactured in a third world country by child labor. And therefore, you're part of the problem. You know, and that's what they'd say. And it's
and
not true.
And of course,
true.
If you were naked, then you'd be a lunatic.
Right. Then you'd be a dirty hippie.
Right.
Can't win with these people, can you?
No, well, I mean, that is the problem. And, you know, I think the interesting thing from my perspective is to watch the way in which the media and the establishment is trying to discredit.
Absolutely.
Because that is, that, you know, at first it was, there's nothing here. We, you know, I mean, it really is following that sort of like classic Gandhi
formulation.
Funny, isn't
it? Yeah.
You know, at first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. Have I missed a step?
I think in America, then they try to assimilate you.
Exactly.
I think that's the next step that's in process.
And at what point do you think the Gap will come out with the Occupy Wall Street line of clothing?
I'm sorry?
The Gap.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's a funny thing you brought up. A number of friends of mine on Facebook are artists and designers, and we've been having this, like, amusing discussion about a fashion line for Occupy Wall Street. And all it takes is a few fashion photographers to come down here and find some of the punk rock fashions that are improvised and do a runway show downtown. Well, Project Runway has not come down here yet. If they were smart, they'd come down here with the Project Runway kids, and they'd work with punk rockers who have their unique fashions and make some kind of fashion statement in response to Occupy Wall Street. That's shot in New York, isn't it?
Yeah, I think actually, I think it's just a matter of time before we get the Fashion Week and the Project Runway. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, in terms of the attempts by the corporate media and the establishment to discredit this and to what do you think about the idea of the comparisons with the Tea Party, and on one hand, and also the calls by some to sort of like reach out to the Tea Party?
Oh, I think that the two main ways in which Occupy Wall Street is similar to the Tea Party is really simple. A lot of people at Occupy Wall Street, they like tea, and they like parties. But after that, there are no similarities. The reason for that is because the Tea Party is manufactured by Fox News largely and promoted as a business, and they make money with their Tea Party Express van that goes around the country promoting conservative and right-wing ideology. And then they also hire people to come and speak at their rallies. And Occupy Wall Street Nobody's paid to be here. If there's any money, it's all donated. People are sleeping here on the cold stone steps of the Occupy Wall Street in the rain. These people, a lot of them are under 30. You know, they're coming here from all over the country because they have a belief that things can be better, and that's what brings them together. And when was the last time you ever saw a right-wing, anti-Jewish, anti-black, anti-multiculturalist group camp out in protest? You never see it. And when has the Tea Party ever rejected nonviolence? They've never done that. They advocate taking weapon, like loaded handguns, rifles, whatever handguns you have, and they advocate Second Amendment remedies through their political opponents. We're nonviolent, completely different worlds, like Mars and the Earth.
Yeah, I think that's about as eloquently put as I've heard.
And what do you? We do like tea and we do like parties, though.
No, that's, I mean, that the tea and parties is good, and I think, let me ask you this, and I think that's a very good from an institutional standpoint, to the extent that you could say that Occupy is in fact even institutional. I think maybe that in and of itself is also a distinction, because there are competing factions, and the Tea Party is institutionalized, and we know that it has received corporate funds. We know that people get paid there. What do you make of a call by like Lawrence Lessig the other day saying there are members of the Tea Party, there are factions of the Tea Party who share the same distaste for corporate cronyism and for crony capitalism, I should say, and there's common ground there. What do you make of that?
I think that's a fake rumor. The Tea Party is not against crony capitalism, and the Tea Party only uses that as a platitude to act like they're actually normal people. But actually, Tea Party people are not a party. They're like a manufactured AstroTurf organization that's pretending to act like an activist group so that they can claim to have support in the political arena. In reality, if you look back at all Glenn Beck's promotional activities from the outset of the Tea Party, it was 24/7 Tea Party this, Tea Party that, and it's all right-wing. Right. There's no grassroots element that's anti-capitalist, anti-corporate. If we had Tea Party rallies around this country saying, get our children health care, you know, let's regulate the financial industry. Maybe I believe it, but I have yet to see any actual movement towards that direction from the Tea Party, so I don't believe it.
Interesting.
It's like asking the Taliban to come into our group as a political fringe to join in our democracy while they're bombing. You know, like it's very incongruent. Like having anarchists who don't want to vote be a part of it is very complicated.
All right. So lastly, where do you see? I mean, give me a sense of where this goes, or do you not necessarily? Is it not helpful necessarily to think about what's going to happen in the near or short term future?
I think that what's been happening is that you've seen that Occupy Wall Street has now succeeded in affecting the political discourse in the country. And even like Rush Limbaugh is attacking Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, saying that he is a part of some kind of democratic industrial complex that's trying to, you know, lead the protesters somewhere, like,
well,
politically. So you know we're succeeding if Rush Limbaugh is hating us.
Well, when you have writers who are communicating with each other and talking about issues via email, I think it's quite clear what's going on.
Yeah, you can't trust writers, you know, because they're going to just write anything they want.
They're going to use probably a computer.
That's
that
right.
Is
clearly hypocrites.
Clearly hypocrites. You know, what kind of radical commie is going to use a computer?
Right, because if you were really a writer, you'd be writing in fountain pen.
Fountain pen.
You probably grind your own pigment for
you. You're talking about a feather. You're talking about a quill.
Yeah,
right.
Maybe we make our own clothes,
right,
like the Amish.
Well, we are actually going to be delivering this this interview. We're going to transcribe it and we're going to hand it to each individual Majority Report listener, so that we cannot be accused of hypocrisy by using any of the capitalist product to deliver this interview. So we will be we'll be writing it out in a quill. And most people will probably not get this interview for a couple of years. We're going to be doing it on parchment as well.
Okay. Well, that sounds great.
But Chris Cobb, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I have to say, this is very exciting for me. This is the first time I've ever been interviewed by Fox News.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right. So, Chris Cobb, thanks very much for joining us. Let me take that one. Ted Alexandro is here. Ted, come on up here. You're gonna get
got the double
you're
double treatment.
Get the double treatment. We want to get this on video, right? Yeah. So let's just we'll vamp here a little bit.
All right,
Ted. What'd you do? You ride your bike down here?
I rode my bike from Astoria.
Oh, and what capitalist operation did you buy that bike from?
I made it myself.
Did you make your bike yourself?
No, that's probably
it's not uncommon. Actually, some people do construct their bikes themselves, but you'd have to make it from some type of, like, bamboo or wicker, I guess.
No, I'm not handy enough, you know.
And I want to say thank you to Matthew. You know who you are, for setting up these interviews and giving me updates on the sound quality. Much appreciated.
Did you know that Matthew and I take the same boxing class? That's how we met.
Wow.
Matthew, who set this up?
Long time sort of Air America listeners will know back in the day when we were doing Break Room Live, and even, I guess, early WTF, people would know Matthew. Matthew and Ted apparently take boxing together.
That's how we met.
I got to say that I hope Matthew has the good sense not to get into the same ring with you.
it's almost like a cardio boxing. We don't even touch each other.
Wow, that's
very loving. It's a loving boxing class.
So, Chad, you're a comedian, right?
Yes.
And so how long have you been coming down to Occupy Wall Street?
I've been coming down since September 19th. I hadn't heard about it initially on the 17th, but then I read about it. And I was really compelled to find out what was going on. And ever since, I've been coming back. I've probably been down here about 25 times.
Now, do you use, are you a political comedian? I mean, do you use, how political do you get in your comedy?
Yeah, somewhat. I do talk about politics. I talk, I do a lot of social commentary, talk about race. So it's a fair amount of what I do. It's not all of what I do, but I do touch on those themes. So definitely this was right in my wheelhouse as far as, the things that I believe and things that I think are important.
So give me a sense of how things have changed from your perspective over the past 32 days.
Well, it's been fascinating, actually, because in the beginning, it really was just a couple of hundred people, and it was small, and it was, largely derided in the media, and even people that you would suspect would be in favor of it were kind of ignoring it. Or dismissing it. So to see the change week to week, especially on the weekends, on the Saturdays, that's when you could see the crowds swelling and you could see the tides shifting in terms of the way it was being perceived.
And so give me a sense of also just, how have you got a sense, at least, not so much even the media, but, I mean, the people around you, comedians tend to be somewhat jaded. And maybe this is sort of a generational thing. I mean, I haven't been really sort of immersed in the comedy world in, 5 or 6, maybe 10 years in the way that I used to. But there was a jadedness. There was, there was like a sort of an anti-hippie feel. There was the idea of sort of people who are earnestly engaged in some type of protest was sometimes frowned upon, even by people who agreed with what the positions were.
Well, I disagree to the extent that I think comedians are jaded, but they're jaded in the sense that, we make fun of the system. We make fun of the way that the system fails us. So to me, this is really right this is the embodiment of a lot of the things that comedians talk about. You know, of course it's easy to make fun of hippies and things like that. Those are easy targets. But the sentiment of what this at the root of this is really what I think informs a lot of what comedians do, which is taking shots at injustice.
Yeah. And have you performed at all? I mean, you know, one of the things I'm interested in, you know, I know like Jamie Kilstein has performed here. Has there been more of that? I mean,
That was in the early going, you know, again, when it was smaller,
right.
and it was just, you know, maybe a couple hundred people. Then it lent itself more to that kind of community building, having the occasional show, the occasional musician. But since it's gotten bigger, I've seen less of that.
That's interesting. What do you think accounts for that? Just for the it's just tough to manage it, or what?
I think it's tough to do comedy outdoors in general, but especially when they're, you know, even when they do the GA here, the people's microphone. You know, people have to yell things repeatedly. So comedy, certainly, they don't do that during comedy performances. But comedians have to yell, and, you know, people such as myself or some of the other guys. Jamie's a little more animated, you know, and forceful and has a bigger voice than I do on stage. So, you know, guys like that are able to maybe project and get their stuff out. But I'm, you know, I don't know that what I do would necessarily translate to an outdoor thing where you have to yell.
I think somebody's missing a great opportunity for some very good conceptual comedy with the people's mic.
That's true.
Somebody's got to figure that out, right?
Crack that code.
I mean, I guess it would be, you know, when I did comedy, I was basically just trying to annoy the audience, which is actually a great recipe if you're a young comedian out there and you want to make sure that you fail at comedy. That, I would say, is one of the best things you can do.
There you go for it?
No. I have some very funny tapes that I look at and enjoy myself in my living room. But short of that, it seems to me that if you just kept repeating over and over again the same word, as everybody in the people's mic would repeat it, at one point it would start to get funny. It may take 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's worth a shot, you know?
No, I wouldn't do it. So give me a sense of what do you think happens going forward from here?
Well, I mean, you know, part of this for me has been the mystery of it and the basic, you know, watching the creative process in front of your eyes. So we don't know week to week or day to day what it's going to be, but I have faith because of what informs it, which is that sense of advocating for social justice and economic justice and all the things that are at the root of this. That's not going to go away. That's only going to get stronger. So I've been fascinated week to week, you know, to see things grow and to see the way that they evolve. Social media plays such a big part, the way that information is swapped and things are planned. Someone was telling me the other day that they're going to put Goldman Sachs on trial. I think at the beginning of November, they're going to have a trial in the park.
Oh, fantastic.
So these types of things are, you know, are fascinating. They make for good theater, but they're also making a strong statement.
Right. Are you a member of a working group at all, or have you decided?
I haven't. You know, I've basically been coming down. I listen in on a lot of things.
Right.
You know, I make signs and stand out there. And I've played in the drum. I'm a musician, so I play in the drum circle from time to time. I've just met a lot of really fascinating people from Lou Reed to Cornel West. Yeah. He took my picture. I was just standing on Broadway. And this guy says, "Do you mind if I take your picture?" And I realize it's Lou Reed. So
I heard Cornel West stole your sign.
Cornel West, he didn't steal my sign. I offered it to him. He came up to me and I said, "Would you like to hold my sign?" And the sign was, "If only the war on poverty was a real war, then we would actually be putting money into it." So he said, "Absolutely." So he stood with us, and then the media swarmed and they were taking pictures. And that picture went viral and went all over Facebook, and the comments were, as usual, "Dr. West says it best."
Nice. You know,
so.
Ghostwriting for Dr. West.
Exactly.
You have another sign for me? Let's get this thing
going.
I've got
some ideas in the hopper, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So you met Lou Reed and
Cornel West. Moore. I just met New York City playground legend Pee Wee Kirkland. Look him up if you don't know him. So, yeah, I've met a lot of fascinating, and of course, people that aren't, you know, just everyday people. I met a couple of 9/11 first responders. You know, just people, everyone's got a fascinating story, a fascinating reason for being here. So, to me, that's the really compelling part of being down here is, you know, this is not something you do lightly, especially these folks that are living here for a month now. You know, the criticism that they receive kind of boggles my mind because it's not fun to sleep on concrete for a month, and they're doing it for a reason and for very just reasons.
I think that's the thing that really, I still contend, you know, there's a lot of, we see a lot of now stories of why has Occupy Wall Street been successful, and I think to a certain extent, you know, this could roll up tomorrow, it's not going to. Everybody involved in this and all their experiences could be wiped away, and you could point to a significant amount of success, at least in changing the narrative. But so you're already getting some of those stories of why has Occupy Wall Street been successful where other protests haven't. And I think the fact that people were sleeping out seems like a fairly obvious reason. I mean, you are basically saying, I have made it impossible for society to have its normal leverage over me, and I am putting myself at great discomfort in a way that these other protests simply don't. It just says we're that much more committed.
It's sustained and it's physical presence. You know, the fact that this encampment, you know, it really embodies all of the things that people are advocating for. It has essentially free health care. It's got a medical table. It's got a library. It's got free food 24/7. It's really the physical encampment itself is embodying and demonstrating and modeling the types of things that people are advocating for.
Well, Ted, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this, and appreciate your coming down here every day.
I'm happy to do it, man.
I appreciate your helping Matthew Weiss on his boxing.
He helps me just as much.
Seriously? Do you want to wait until we're off?
Yeah, we'll talk more later.
You want to wait until we're off? Because I find that very hard. You know, Matthew was, you know how I met Matthew was on a film I did 10 years ago now. I hired him as my assistant and then hired him to play my assistant in the movie just to make sure that he wouldn't wander off. And he still did.
And he still did.
Yeah. He's still very difficult. Now he's much more mature now. So for any of his
film and video,
any of his film and video clients, just know that he's a lot more responsible now than he apparently was at the time. But Ted, thanks so much for joining
us.
Thank
you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take, we won't take a break. It's time now for our longtime, maybe our first official Majority Report correspondent ever. Probably our only, but hopefully not our last. Of course, I'm talking about Jeff Smith, who came down here on the 17th, was IMing me saying, I'm going down to this protest. And then just started giving us updates, and now look at him, folks. We'll have a video of this, but get a shot. He has a badge that says Occupy Wall Street Press Team. Now, I should say the badge is, it seems to be half of a baggie with a written piece of paper. But it's true. He is that guy now. He's now part of the press team here at Occupy Wall Street. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Sam. It's great. And as I've mentioned to people, some people don't really understand. We don't really do PR per se. So as a press team member, I interface with the press. I kind of help them out. But at the same time, I don't give them too much help. I think a lot of what I've discovered with a lot of journalists, they expect the story just to be handed them. They want the press release and just write it down, tell me the facts so I can go back and file it. And what we sort of force the journalists to do here is actually do their job, report on the story.
That's stunning, isn't it? I mean, that's the one thing that I think I learned when I got into this business from being a comedian was like, there are a lot of lazy journalists. That just sort of stunned me because, I mean, I don't even consider myself a journalist, although I think, arguably I am. I think sort of dispositionally it's still hard for me to sort of accept that. And it's because I perceive journalists to be a lot more sort of diligent than I am. Maybe that's just sort of a, but it is stunning to me in moments like that. Has that been one of the things that working from this perspective has sort of shocked you or no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a clear sort of line between almost the entertainment journalists and the real journalists. And you can see the ones that come up here, they expect essentially the script, the actors, the set. You know, this is what I'm doing. Even here's my narrative. I need the pieces to fill into that, as opposed to actually reporting on what's going on here and creating a narrative around what, you know, they actually see. So, it's been very interesting. And I think that, again, part of our strategy here, I think, is to not play the game that they want us to play.
See, that's interesting because you get to walk a line there, too, don't you? Because it's important to get the message out. Now I think there's a certain amount of critical mass, so that's happened already on some level. But there was a time 2 or 3 weeks ago where it was important to get the message out. I know that the media was having a hard time figuring out how do we even report on this, just by the very fact that I was getting phone calls to go on TV to talk about it was an indication to me, like, they just don't know what to do. Like, the bookers don't know who to talk to. There's no, the normal PR channels aren't there. The media press person that they would call and they'd say, oh, we'll send you out the packet, wasn't there. And so they didn't know what to do. So you had to sort of like walk a line, yeah or no?
For sure. I think part of what I've sort of seen is that even for the bigger mainstream media establishment outlets, that the guys that come down here, the cameramen, the crew, those people are almost like the blue shirts. And, you know, when some guy comes down working for, you know, Hardball Chris Matthews, it's almost like Chris Matthews is the white shirt. He's the boss.
Right.
And he's got to do what the sort of establishment tells him. And so when the cameraman comes down here and says, I need this for this story or whatever, and I kind of am hard on him about the angle the story's taken, they're like, hey, man, I'm just doing my job, you know, don't shoot the messenger sort of thing. And it's a similar scene that I've seen with CNN as well. I mean, I know Aaron Burnett and the Wolf Blitzer crowd has sort of been sort of the worst of the coverage here. But at the same time, there's like guys that just work in the truck in CNN that have been down here with us. In a lot of ways, I think they have solidarity with this, with
right.
this movement.
They're told to come down here, get certain B-roll, get somebody saying, flibbity flu, and so we can put it on, like, so we can say, like, we don't know what these people are saying. They're saying flibbity flu. So I just made that up, the flibbity flu part. So, all right, so there's a lot of news. I mean, down here today, just give me a sense of who's expected to come down here today, because there's a lot of very interesting people who are supposedly heading down here today.
Yeah, we've got word that Paul Krugman will be down here a little bit later, around 6:30. He and his wife are coming, and I think she's going to be speaking on his behalf. In some measure of maintaining his journalistic objectivity, I think, on this. But obviously in the paper, he's been very supportive of what's going on.
Right.
So I think he's going to come down here for the first time. Also, Diane Ravitch, the sort of noted education
Diane
scholar.
Ravitch is a really interesting story for people don't know. Now, I've talked about her a little bit in the past. I've tried to get her as a guest on the show. It's just very difficult. She was, I think, even in the Bush administration, certainly a big advocate of sort of the corporatization, the privatization of schools. And after a while, I think it was, I don't know exactly what was the linchpin of her sort of conversion in some respects. I think to a large extent it was running the data and finding that charter schools in the aggregate do not perform better than public schools. In fact, it may just be the opposite by a small margin, but they cost a lot. They drain resources from public schools, and she has become a very strong advocate against the corporate reform movement of our education. So she's heading down here, and she's also become obviously very supportive of teachers, because teachers are often the sort of the ones targeted in this movement, because it is the teachers union that is the bulwark against this corporatization of our school system.
No, I agree. I mean, I kind of think of Diane Ravitch as almost like the Elizabeth Warren of the, you know, protecting our education system, the way that Elizabeth Warren was sort of in that sense protecting consumer rights. And I think that a particular gripe that she has is the fact that it's Bill Gates and, you know, Joel Klein and these guys that have come in that have real no education background,
right,
all of a sudden assuming we know how to run schools, we can do it better, it's like a business, you know.
Well, that's the thing, is that the idea, every educator I talk to, the interesting thing, and it's frustrating from my perspective, because I want to be able to deliver a clear message as to why corporate reform of schools is wrong. But the thing is that educators, they don't work that way. Genuine educators actually believe that the best system is one which is not so systematized as to not look at the individuals that they're dealing with at any given time. And so it's very hard to come up with a bumper sticker for that, because there is no one size fits all, other than maybe there is no one size fits all. And the corporatization mentality is one that there is one size that fits all. There is one recipe, and that recipe also can be measured in a very simple metric, which we will use tests, let's say, to impose that metric. And so it's very hard to argue against that, because there's no one clear answer to fight back that narrative. And, of course, the corporate reform movement has a tremendous amount of money, which, again, sort of brings up a similar dynamic that's going down here. So we've got Krugman and Diane Ravitch. That's just today, folks. I feel like I'm like one of those radio guys who's like, come on down to Eddie's Buick. If you come down today, but honestly, I mean, this is one of the reasons you come down here, is just because there's so much interesting going on. I mean, these people are not celebrities per se, but they're very interesting speakers, and an opportunity to hear them speak.
No, I mean, you know, the other day a representative from L'Equilessa came down here, said he's interested in addressing the group. Jesse Jackson was down here. So, I mean, the caliber of people.
Tell the story about the Jesse Jackson with the tents, because one of the first things I noticed when I got here was that there was a couple of tents and, like, tarps that were, like, tied to the trees in anticipation of possible rain, and that was pretty shocking, because I had never seen that before down here. Why are we seeing this now?
Really, it just popped up earlier this week. Someone put up a medical tent, and you know, as I've said before, we've been sort of pushing the boundaries continually, knowing that if we forced the cops to just continue to come in, eventually they would just get tired of it. And as it happened the other night, they came in to take down the medical tent, and it was about 11:30 at night, and mysteriously Jesse Jackson just showed up and was there. And so everyone locked arms and surrounded the tent, including Jesse Jackson, and they began singing, you know, old spirituals. I mean, it was probably the most intimidating force you could imagine for cops, thinking, like, what's my boss going to say if I pull these guys in? Like,
right. What
I'm going
to
lose my job if I arrest Jesse Jackson. And they totally backed off.
And now there's, I guess, a concern that at any moment that they deal with the tent, Jesse Jackson's going to show up. Were people aware that he was in the park, or he just sort of seemed coming out of nowhere?
He kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, he returned the next day, but again, it was 11:30 at night. I don't think he was coming here to be in front of cameras or to grab attention. And I think that's the cool thing about this, is that celebrities actually want to come here just to sort of bask in the feeling. It's such an incredible atmosphere down here. And I think even celebrities have, you know, they're almost in such a jaded world.
Right.
Where, you know, everything's PR and, you know, everything's kind of fake. And what's going on down here is really real.
And Krugman and Ravitch, was there somebody, I think you'd mentioned one other, I can't remember who it was. So give me a sense of what's the next big, what's the next thing that you're looking towards? Ted mentioned that in November they're talking about putting Goldman Sachs on trial. What are other things that, because it seems to me that, and I mean, I even noticed this in my podcast numbers, that, you know, sort of these things grow in spikes. There's a spike, then it calms down for a little bit, but the baseline raises after that spike, and then there's another spike, and the baseline raises again. What do you perceive is going to be the next spike?
You know, I'm not sure. Obviously, they kind of come on the weekends is when we feel like we have the best time to do something big. There's so many people. I mean, I talked to an artist a couple weeks ago who was here from L.A., and he just sort of canceled his future plans because he's working on a huge Occupy Halloween that's coming up, and they're going to plan a big sort of artistic demonstration. I mean, so much of this, you talk about theater.
I think they're going to have a float in it.
Yeah, a lot of what is going on here is about political theater, is about shaming certain individuals that have gotten away with it in society. Basically, every tool that we have nonviolently to sort of gum up the system, to mess with the man, so to speak. And so I think that's the kind of thing. But they'll definitely be new stuff. I mean,
right.
People are planning behind the scenes at all times here.
Right. And I imagine there's a certain amount of pressure to do that because our society, I mean, that's the way that we measure it. I mean, you know, that's, you know, as somebody who's sort of reporting on what's going on down here, that's what I want to know. I want to know what the new thing is going to be in that regard. Now, one of the things that happened this week was that there was, and you give me a better sense of this, so the people don't, you know, there seems to be multiple levels to this, and one of the levels is that there's sort of operational things that happen in this park, which are the foundation of the entire movement, but they really only relate to what happens in this park. You know, whether it's sort of, you know, organizing this area is where the medical tent is going to be, this area is where the library is going to be, this is where the food's going to be. And there's a new General Assembly website that was put up. What's the URL for it? It's
nycga.net.
And it gives like a map of this area, not of how to get here, but of this park. And it's a fascinating site. I mean, people should check this out because it allows you to get involved in many different ways. But tell me about what's happening with the different groups. Operationally speaking, are there groups that emerge as sort of like, wow, that's a coveted group to be on, or that group is really important because, you know, everybody wants food or everybody wants a blanket. What's happening sort of like within the context of the construction of this environment?
No, there's always groups popping up. You literally can't have a latest list of groups at any given time. I hear about them, you know, there's like structures and, you know, for the actual people that have put up the tents and tarps, that's actually now a separate functioning working group. There are all kinds of internal sort of cross-communication channels, guys that are sort of runners, almost PAs, that are now connecting groups in different ways. And we have a lot of sort of information architecture type of people that are actually working on different either email systems or shared documents and these open source websites to make this thing function. And so I think one of the things about moving into the winter, actually, we may end up sort of contracting a little bit to a more of a core group of people, but I think that may help us operationalize this and get the system down even more. So like you say, in the springtime, this could just become
right.
Really,
I would imagine that is one thing that people are wanted to do is like, how do we now create a virtual occupation to enhance the occupation here during those months where it's going to be very difficult to get to mobilize people in the same way just because it's going to be a very harsh situation. And I would imagine also, how do we support the people? What can we do operationally? I mean, you were talking about, you know, it's been reported that Occupy Wall Street now has at least $300,000 in the bank. I've been some of the media, the live stream has like $75,000, and maybe that's part of the same account. And then the question is, what do you spend the money on?
No, absolutely, and it's a difficult situation because people here are very frugal with the money. Frankly, even though it's coming in. And we're accruing this balance. It's the very few things that have come through the General Assembly. There was a proposal about subway cards after the Times Square event. People were considering buying a bunch of subway cards for the group to occupy the subway. And it was going to be a couple thousand dollars, and it got voted down. People just didn't want to spend the money. And so we've got basically $100 is the maximum limit for sort of petty cash for each of the working groups on a daily basis. But beyond that, pretty much everything has to go through the General Assembly. And I think finance will become an area where we need to probably get tighter. I know we have sort of a professional accountant that's handling the books now, and I think we want to make this very transparent. We don't want it to be like a typical NGO where it's a funnel of money coming into who knows where and going out who knows where. So I think even when we do buy something substantial, I think we want to be transparent about it and show the expenditure. So it'll be interesting.
And, you know, lastly, talk to me about the demands group. I mean, one of the pieces I saw this week, I was talking about the two different demands group, and we had just briefly spoken. You said that it was actually even more, and I'm curious as to, from the very beginning, I've been one of those people who said there should be no demand. I mean, there are already implicit demands. I read that when you emailed me, you had talked about those implicit demands that were more or less explicit. We demand to occupy this space. We demand the right to express ourselves in this regard. And, I feel very strongly that the message coming out of here is that there's something wrong. Fix it so that we feel that we can leave. I mean, that's a fairly, we're going to jam up the system, and until the system starts to accommodate us, it's your job to figure out what's going to accommodate us, and then this will end eventually. But with that said, it is interesting to see how it's functioning with the different demands and the different, and I think even the competing demands groups that come out give us an indication of where the, in the neighborhood of at least where these, where the people who are intimately involved in this stand on the issues and relative to the rest of society. So give me a sense, to the extent that you know, of what the different demands groups have been doing, what happens when they go to the General Assembly, and what did happen. Let me know what you know on that, Court.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like you said, I think it's a great conversation starter to even have these groups and start debating it, and I think these are the kind of debates, frankly, that we wish we were having instead of these, you know, mock debates on the GOP, Republican debates where they talk about nothing.
We have Teamsters here. We have the 99%. The This is, we're in the middle of a people's mic. Some Teamsters.
CEO makes $10,600 a day.
And Teamsters are talking about being locked out of their jobs for 3 months at Sotheby's. There's a yellow bus down here that they brought down here. And they're looking for people to join them on the picket line.
We've actually, in previous protests, where they actually disrupted a Sotheby's auction, where people kind of infiltrated and then one by one stood up and kind of interrupted the thing. So we've been kind of participating with the Teamsters for a while on this one.
That would explain the Van Gogh that is sitting in the middle of the park. Somebody won a Van Gogh at one of the Sotheby's auctions. I was joking about that. Somebody's looking for the Van Gogh. So, I'm sorry. So we were in the middle of talking about the different demands groups and
what's
happening.
So, as I said, I think that it's the beginning of a great debate, great conversation to have. But at this point, I think it's probably apocryphal to say that we have a listed set of demands or that that's going to be necessarily coming through soon. But I think it's great that that's becoming the narrative or the story of what's going here.
Is there a place that we can actually see, what the different working groups are working on, or do they present it to the General Assembly? Like, for instance, my understanding is that one of the working group presented something to the General Assembly on Tuesday night, and basically it was tabled because
right.
There wasn't agreement on. Was the lack of a consensus on the demands or the idea of demands?
That's basically, yes, that's what a lot of the contention happens in the General Assembly, when there'll be a decision to be made, and then someone will block that decision, and then there'll be a vote on the decision to make the decision, and then that will somehow be blocked. So that sometimes does hang up the process a bit. But as I said, I mean, I think that It'll be a while before we really need to have demands that are expressly
right.
stated, because who would listen to them anyway?
Right.
And in the meantime, it honestly seems like we may start seeing them be met without us even having to say it. I mean,
right.
There may be some prosecutions that happen on Wall Street just mysteriously. All of a sudden, Eric Holder decides to, start doing his job, and maybe we're the cause of it, maybe we aren't. But as you said, I mean, if Eric Cantor's talking about it, if Rick Santorum is on the side of the 99%, obviously we're, you know, doing something out there.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think it's undisputable, the implications. Now, there's a big other. The Teamsters are doing another mic check, moving to a different part of the park, and talking about getting people to come down to Sotheby's.
I did want to mention also, though, the kids' event. I mean, it was postponed previously, but on Friday night, we're going to have a parents bring their kids to sleep over in the park, and I want everyone to be known that it's going to be extremely tight security. We're actually going to have a separate area out. There'll be a checkpoint for security for the group. Everyone will have, like, T-shirts on that designate that they're, like, safe and part of the group. So it's really about trying to make sure everyone realizes this is about kids and families and really everyone in society. It isn't just hippies protesting in a park. And in a lot of ways, this is more important for kids and the next generation than anyone.
Right.
And I mean, think people are starting to feel that.
I think I talked about it a little bit, but I brought Mila down here on Columbus Day. And I found out when I got back from the conference in Vegas that she was asked, what did you think about Occupy Wall Street? And she said, I think it was inappropriate for a six-year-old to be there because I could have been arrested. And I think for a six-year-old it was a little bit intimidating. And I think part of it was also she had insisted upon watching the bridge footage of people being arrested. And so I was explaining it to her. But so I don't know if I can get her to come down again, spend the night, maybe. But I noticed a lot of kids who were a little bit older, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12, not 11, but 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and they seem to be really into it. And I think, you know, at that age, it's a great age to bring the kids down here. I mean, I'm on a couple of email lists where the advent of this, when this first started happening, people were recounting going to protests back in the 60s as a child and being brought down there with the parents. And it really had an impact on them and their perspective on it. And the people down here are incredibly nice, very supportive. Like Jeff said, there's going to be great security here. So, you know, it's a great opportunity. You know, I wanted Mila to come down here and just know that she was here at the early stages of this, because I really do believe this is, in one shape or another, the beginning of a movement that is going to resonate over the next years. And particularly, you know, I actually believe that this movement will gain even more strength, frankly, and coincidentally, if Obama is reelected. I mean, I think one of the things that has allowed for this movement to grow is that it is not easily co-optable by the liberal establishment because they aren't in direct opposition to everything that's happening in Washington. And I think to a certain extent, that gives space for people to step outside of that and create an opposition to everything that's happening in the establishment, not just those who are oppositional within the establishment. Does that make sense?
Sure. No, absolutely. It was kind of meta there, but I get it. No,
I'm getting a little bit meta, but it's towards the end of the show. It is time to get that meta. All right, folks. So I'm going to start wrapping it up today a little bit on the short side. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties that we had during the course of the show, but what are you going to do? Live?
You know, Sam, there's a quick story. You talk about the theater or what could be done that's funny out here on the Friday morning when the sanitation crews were supposedly going to show up early in the morning. It was kind of tense, and there was a van parked out in the front. Not John Benjamin's van, but just a van, unattended. And a cop was coming around, like saying, "Like, who's got? You know, someone's got to move this van. Can't stay here." And he inadvertently, basically, stepped up to the people's mic. And so everything the cop would say, the whole crowd would start repeating. And the cop got really uncomfortable with it and kind of walked away. It freaked him out. But
Have there been other cops who have done that on purpose? I mean, have the cops come in and ask, or do they just come in with their megaphone when they get an
ask? They come in with the megaphone, but I don't think any cop has been actually officially on the people's mic, but...
Now, tell me, you know, you were telling me there's a couple of, you know, sort of cool cops that are around here, and I'm not talking about the hipster cop.
Right.
The hipster cop, if you don't know, is a community affairs cop who has been, like, sort of dubbed the hipster cop because he dresses like a hipster, right? I mean, is that basically what it was?
Sure, sure. No, there's a lot of cool cops. I mean, some of them are older guys that are soon to retire, and they're kind of not looking to advance their careers by beating up kids or something. And then a lot of the kind of rank-and-file guys that I think really do identify with us in a lot of ways. And sometimes I wonder, looking down the road, at some point whether they just won't all turn and join us. Like, when this thing gets big enough, you know, almost like the military in Egypt, which is not to say that they already, I think, have avoided doing some of the things that the white shirts have done. I think that's why you see the white shirts right. constantly grabbing kids. But more and more, I think, I'm hoping that they'll feel comfortable, you know, representing themselves among us, because it's really about everyone.
You know, when I was out in Madison covering the protests against Scott Walker there, I just happened to be there on the day when the firefighters showed up. And it was a big deal because the firefighters and the cops had basically been left out of Scott Walker's attack on public service unions. And when they showed up, it was a real turning point, at least for the sense of unity there, because it really bridged that divide that was sort of still there from the vestiges of the 60s, where sort of the law and order types wouldn't hang out with the sort of the protesting types. And I mean, it was quite clear there too. You know, you had welders and guys who wouldn't normally be in the same protest as teaching assistants, you know, from University of Madison. And so I do think that would be a massive, that would be a massive, massive turning point. I mean, if you actually saw cops just sort of at one point just step over the barricades. I don't think you will, because guys have their jobs, but certainly I think you can see a lot of times the cops are sympathetic. And
I think the people here are sympathetic with the cops. I mean, there's a lot of chants, particularly directly at the cops, like, you are part of us. We're doing this for you, too. And I think secretly, even if they can't show it, they appreciate it.
Right.
And, you know, so much of what this is about is, like, the functions, you know, the government workers in our society that we really need, whether it's doctors or teachers or even artists and all the people that contribute to society in ways that people feel, it feels like they've all been locked out in this new system. And it's really the people that operated, you know, on the 42nd story of
right.
these huge buildings that never even really, their feet don't hit the pavement and they don't interact with these people anyway. And they're just sucking up all the money and have kind of created their own system. But the idea that, I mean, that's the main thing when you contrast the Tea Party and what's going on here. I don't think people think of government as bad. I think what's going on here more is that people are realizing government is us. And if we create our own government, it can totally serve exactly the needs that we need. And so that's physically what's going on in this park. And I think that's the sort of system we imagine is possible in the whole country.
Jeff, couldn't be a better note to end the show on. Thanks again. Thank you. I can't thank you enough. I mean, you've been a real connection for me personally, but also for the show. I mean, I think, you know, there are people all across, frankly, the world who listen to this show from Iran and Cairo, and it's pretty stunning to see the distribution of where podcasts go. But in this country, and I think you've been sort of an invaluable resource for all of us, and I'm just very thankful that you're here. So
it's been a pleasure. I enjoy doing it.
All right, folks. So that is the show for today. Thank you for bearing with us on some of the technical difficulties that we've had. We will be back tomorrow. It is, of course, tomorrow is, what is tomorrow? Friday. And, folks. Oh, podcastawards.com, please. if you can head over to podcastawards.com and give us a vote for People's Choice and Best Politics News news podcast. You can vote every single day. It makes a difference. And of course, as always, this is the moment where I beg you to become a Majority Report member. I'm a little bit too chilly right now to really get into full begging mode. Matt's just nodding his head. It's cold. But if you can become a member, if you can afford it, please do. Had to spend $15 on batteries today alone. It was close to like $50, didn't we spend $50? Oh, we had to get umbrellas. We showed up here. We thought it was going to rain. I was like, shit, we got to get umbrellas. So if you can become a member, much appreciated. And, of course, you can support the show by buying your crap through that Amazon link. JustCoffee.coop for your coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic if you want it that way. Co-op. 10% coupon code majority in the coupon box. See you tomorrow, folks. Don't forget to go to podcastawards.com. Oh, wait, that's not our closing song. Oh, yeah. Sorry, folks. Let's do this.
It might take us to that guy.
All right, folks. See you tomorrow.
But I know some.